Hi, I'm Mel Majoros. I am a 7-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. So I found my next guest via email. Sometimes people contact me because they've heard the show or read the blog or have just heard about The Cancer Warrior, and she has written two fantastic books for cancer survivors and caregivers and kids. Her name is Deborah J. Cornwall, and let's jump right into it. How are you today, Deborah?
I'm just fine, Mel. How are you doing?
Excellent, excellent. So you are a breast cancer survivor yourself. Tell me a little bit about that before we jump into your authorship.
Sure. It was something I never thought I'd say. Mm-hmm. Cancer did not run in my family, and I had been doing a variety of volunteer leadership roles with the American Cancer Society for years, and somehow I thought I knew a lot about cancer, but it's not until you get the diagnosis yourself, I think, that all of a sudden you go, oh, that's what it's about. And it becomes personal. It becomes less your classic doing something good and giving back and much more something that in which you're emotionally invested. It was a total surprise, even though the diagnostic process was long and drawn out. And it really, I think what I came to appreciate is that cancer changes you in ways that you could never anticipate up front. So I was very lucky. Which I realized at the time, although it was very much like being hit in the gut with a 2x4.
Yes.
I think I cried for 2 weeks. I was very lucky. I got into, literally within 24 hours of getting the news, I got booked with a wonderful surgeon, wonderful team at Mass General Hospital, and I actually had my surgery within 2 weeks of the diagnosis. This was right over the Thanksgiving holiday, which, of course, was lovely.
Oh, yes.
I only had to have a lumpectomy, radiation, and tamoxifen, and it became as much, what I realized after writing my books is that it became as much of a cancer non-event as it could be. And I know that sounds like a very awkward expression, cancer non-event, but when you talk with people who have had really horrendous experiences, you learn the difference between a real life-threatening event and what I call a cancer non-event. So I was very, very lucky.
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree. I had a stage one grade three breast cancer, so you do see the difference between people who have stage four, say, lung cancer or ovarian cancer, and you know, your non-event really changed you. And you were saying you had your, you found out right after 9/11.
It was shortly after that. It was within about 2 weeks after that. I had been going through a series of callbacks. You know, the we need one more shot. We need to do an ultrasound. We need to do this, that, and the other thing. And I was working full time, and I would get home at night. And you know, a number of your listeners have probably had this happen to them, where you get the message from the radiology department saying we need you to come back.
Yes.
And then you call back, and they say, well, we can't see you for 2 or 3 weeks. And finally, on the third callback, I said, may I speak to your supervisor? And the supervisor got on the line, and I explained the problem, and she said, well, I mean, we don't have any openings unless I come in one day early. I said, fine, which day would you like?
That's awesome.
And it was a really important moment for me, because what I realized was, at least at the time, which was, you know, almost 14 years ago, the system was not set up for me.
No.
It was set up for their convenience. And it was my first lesson in how you absolutely had to advocate for yourself. And that was one of the most important messages that came through from people I interviewed for my books. You have to do it yourself because nobody's going to do it for you. You are not as important to them as you are to you.
Right. I agree. And I think a lot of that seemed to have changed in the last 14 years, at least in the last 8 years since I've been cancer-free, that, you know, now if I need an X-ray at the local hospital, they're like, well, you can just go in and get it done yourself. Not, you know, do it yourself.
Yeah.
But I'm just
exactly.
Like, what? I can just, like, walk in there and get an X-ray done? Whereas, like, you know, just 5-6 years ago, you have to make an appointment, you know, wait for them to call, see if that's okay, you know, do the whole thing.
That's a wonderful change in the system. As much controversy as there is today about healthcare, you know, I think one of the wonderful changes is that healthcare is coming late to the customer service game, but it's coming.
Right. I agree.
And that's one of the things you talk about in your book.
Absolutely. In fact, my first book.
Your first book, yes.
Which is Things I Wish I'd Known, Cancer Caregivers Speak Out. I started working on in 2010, late 2009, 2010. I interviewed almost 95, I think it was 95 caregivers for 117 patients. And
well, wait, before you, how did you find your caregivers / patients?
That was it was fascinating.
Yes.
Because as you know, HIPAA requirements are such that nobody mm-hmm. can refer you. The medical institutions, the nurses, the doctors can't refer you to patients.
Which is good, you know.
Which is good, but it makes it a little challenging when you're, you know, trying to do this kind of work. So what was interesting was I did two major things. One of them was I had had a lot of contact with the American Cancer Society's Hope Lodges.
Okay.
And a Hope Lodge, in case you don't know or some of your listeners don't know, it's basically free lodging for patients who are coming more than 35 miles to get their treatment at major cancer centers. They exist across the country. I think there are over 30 of them now. And we happened to have one in Boston. And I had, through my work with the American Cancer Society, had some contact with the other two in Massachusetts and one in Vermont. So I had the opportunity to meet some of the managers there. So I thought, well, this is one useful source. And so I posted notices that I was looking for people to talk to. And it was almost like you have to throw out the bait and find people who would like to talk. The other thing that I did was I sent out emails to everyone that I knew on a personal basis and said, here's what I'm doing. I'm looking for these kinds of people who want to talk. You know, any referrals would be appreciated. And this one day, you really learn so much about what has happened to society through instant communications. This one day, I got a phone call from a woman who said, I understand you're writing a book. I'd like to be interviewed. And she said, my sister died of breast cancer. I'd like to be interviewed. And before I asked her where she lived, I asked her how she'd gotten my name. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you sent an email which went out of Massachusetts. I'm from south of Boston. She said, it left the state. It went to somewhere in New England. It went from there to somewhere in the Midwest.
Oh.
And it came to me on the third bounce or the third, you know, kick.
Right.
And it turned out she lived 10 minutes from my house.
That's funny.
And so what it tells you is there are lots of ways to find people.
Yikes.
And I was blown away at how much the caregivers wanted to talk because no one had ever asked most of these people
right.
what their experience was like.
I think caregivers are the unsung heroes. And probably with the advent of your book, I think even before, well, your book came out after I was diagnosed, I noticed mm-hmm. there were not a lot of, I guess, courses or anything to...
Right.
help the caregivers. It's just like, okay, well, you know, your girlfriend is a cancer patient now. Here you go. Take care of her.
It's really true, Mel. And I had originally thought about writing a book on survivors, and I had a professional person who is in the publishing business who very smartly said, you know, there are a lot of books out there, and yours will not stand out if you focus on survivors. And so you might want to think about caregivers. And the more I thought about it, I said, you know, and I did a quick scan on Amazon, and there were not the kinds of resources there that I thought were needed.
Right.
And so that's really what got me focused. That and the fact that I just have to share this one little tidbit,
yes.
which was my mother's sister, my aunt, who is now in her 90s. At the time, I would come back from my visits at Hope Lodge. My husband and I have gone in to serve holiday meals and so on to the guests. And the Hope Lodge is people come with a caregiver, and many times they can't get home for a holiday because they're from, you know, other states or all over the world. And so I would be sharing these stories with my aunt, and she'd say, oh, you've got to write a book. You've got to write a book. And I said, Marjorie, come on. She said, no, you could do it if you wanted to. And after about 2 weeks, I called her back and I said, I'm writing a book. And, you know, it was one of those things where you had to really get your head in gear and say, you know, this is important enough that it's worth figuring out how to do it.
Exactly. Exactly. So how many caregivers did you interview for your first book?
I interviewed 95, and there was no magic number other than
right.
getting to a point where I was hearing the same thing so many times, I said, it's time to write. And they represented 100, or took care of, 117 patients. And the patients were from 19 states and two provinces of Canada, and they ranged in age from 2 to 92.
Whoa.
which is amazing. And I would say about half of them had survived, about half of them had not.
Mm-hmm.
And they represented, believe it or not, over 40 different kinds of cancers. And one of the things that I have learned through this research and through talking to people and through my own volunteer work since is how complicated a disease cancer is.
Oh, yes.
And the unpredictability and, frankly, the maliciousness. It sounds odd to attribute a person with personal characteristics.
Oh, no. It isn't.
It's a malicious disease that just keeps morphing and morphing and morphing.
It does. And but the one good thing is that it brings cancer survivors together and caregivers as well, regardless of the type of cancer that you have.
In ways that they never anticipated. And I think one of the most important learnings for everyone that I talked with, and I have to say two-thirds of the interviews, two-thirds to three-quarters were done by phone. So these are people that if I were in the same room with them, I would not recognize.
Right.
They were so appreciative and they were so changed by the experience that it was really quite striking.
Well,
I actually had one woman who was thanking me profusely. We were on the phone and we'd spoken for about an hour and a half. And I mean, she was just, these people were just incredibly generous with their stories, their most intimate concerns and experiences. And she was thanking me profusely for talking with her. And I said, you know, I really should be thanking you. And she said, no, you don't understand. She said, my husband died 4 years ago. And she said, my friends think I should be over it now. And they think
they
don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And she said, this is the first time that anybody has really wanted to hear my story.
And I think that's, you know, I still feel that sometimes, and you probably do as well. And I'm sure caregivers do. It's like, okay, well, sometimes even now, 7-8 years out, I still feel like I need to talk about it. And if it's not someone in the cancer community, I feel like, oh, well, there's that girl who had cancer. She wants to talk about it again. It's like, well, yeah, because it's, you know, you can't get over the death of your husband. I mean, seriously, no, come on.
And she has now moved on and is married again, but she's, you know, he's still with her. And so I think it's really interesting. The only thing that is so interesting in hindsight, and I'm going through an experience with a business colleague right now who is dying of pancreatic cancer.
Oh, yes.
And I'm taking over a number of his responsibilities. And when I talk with these various vendors, and in many cases I'm having to explain, I need you not to follow procedures and send him emails and call him on the phone to get the transition done because he can't talk to you. And what is so interesting is at the end of that conversation, they always say, I hope he's feeling better. And it's what you realize is people have difficulty confronting the fact that a disease can be life-threatening unless they've actually lived it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think most of us before we had cancer always saw the TV and movie people where they just had, all of a sudden they were looked sallow and they were bald and then they got sick and then they got better.
And so that's what people do. They get better.
Right.
And the reality is some of them do and some of them don't. And the caregiving experience is something that is unpredictable,
mm-hmm.
and the concern is that you can't change the outcome.
Right.
Personally, you can't change the outcome. And there were actually four key messages that came out of the first book that I thought were so important and particularly apply to the second. One of them was the loss of control. There is a sense that all of a sudden the rug has been pulled out. Everything, you know, I used to feel like I was on stable ground and I had some control over my life and where it was going. And the sense of control absolutely goes away and is really hard to get back if you ever get it back. The second was hope and the fact that on the one hand, they want to know how things are progressing, but on the other hand, they need hope to be maintained. And they need to be able to get up each day and say there's something that I can be hopeful about, and I can transfer that hope to the person I'm caring for. The third was isolation, and there is such a tendency for both the patients and the caregivers to say, I'm so busy, I am going 24/7, I don't have time to interact with people who I thought were my friends and maybe have distanced themselves or maybe are really trying to help, but I can't figure out how. And the last one was normalcy and the fact that they're always just, I won't say desperate, but they are really struggling to reinvent what is now going to be my normal. And the reason I like those 4 points is that if you take the word chin, C-H-I-N, it's actually an acronym that embodies control, hope, isolation, and normalcy. And it's an easy way to remember what are the things that people who are going through this are really confronting, and are there ways that I can help them on any one of those 4 fronts?
And that's you basically covered it right there.
Yeah, it was really useful, and I only crystallized it after the first book was published when I was having to talk about the book, and I thought, well, I've got to find something memorable that will hook people and allow them to figure out what's going on with this person, either the survivor or the patient or the caregiver, and how can I help them get through this? And I think understanding those 4 issues that spell chin, that chin refers to, it was really a useful way to do it.
And I think one of the key things for to have either a caregiver or a cancer survivor remain in the normalcy, as it were, I would say, you know, you don't always have to ask, well, how are you feeling, or how is your wife? Don't, you know what, there were so many times where I would get like 10 people asking me, how are you feeling? You know, I just want to hear about your day.
Exactly. You know? I want to talk about something that isn't cancer.
Right.
And cancer hasn't tainted.
But I think a lot of people don't realize that, because they think, well, you know, I want to know how you're doing. So how are you feeling? And you know, it's just, I remember like the 10th person asking me how I'm doing. I'm like, why can't you just ask me how, you tell me what you're up with your boyfriend? And you know, and they were just like, what?
The other one that I found was so interesting was I had a number of people say, don't ask me an open-ended question, how can I help?
Right.
Because I am having to make too many decisions all day long. Mm-hmm. Give me something where I can give you, where if you give me something that requires a yes or no answer, I can do that. So ask me, can I bring you dinner Tuesday or Thursday?
Right.
Or can I bring you chicken or fish? You know, something that is, and it sounds so silly, but
they have great websites that have set things set up like that. So you can just go, can you do anything? Go to this website. That'll tell you what you can do. And that way that'll
But you know what's so interesting, Mel, is a lot of people aren't getting steered to those locations. And so one of the things in both of my books that I've tried to do is to steer people to references, to electronic sites, to information on the internet that can make it easier for them. And I think there's such a tendency to say, I can tough this out.
Oh, yeah, I thought that too. And looking back, it's like people said they would help me, and I was just like, no, the pride took over. And I'm, and you know, looking back, it's like when people say they want to help you, they genuinely want to help you and take the help. Don't throw your pride aside.
This is something that I'm experiencing with my associate most recently, is that sometimes there's this intense sense of privacy, and I had to deal with that when I was diagnosed, because I had had friends who had been diagnosed and wouldn't connect with people, wouldn't accept help, and wouldn't describe what was happening to them, and I decided that I had a choice. And it was a fundamental turning point. The choice was either, you know, stuff it and keep it to yourself, or talk about it in ways that will help other people down the pike who will be as surprised as I was. So I talk, and I chose the latter route.
So now getting to that, we're talking about your next book, Cancer and Kids, because a lot of parents, you know, they find out their kids are they have cancer, and then are like, oh my goodness, what next?
Well, and they're also, Mel, the other thing that is so striking, and it came through in many of the interviews that I did for the first book, and I should have counted them up for you, so I'm sorry I can't tell you the proportion, but there was a significant proportion who, and I would say over 40%, who either had to explain a parental cancer to a child in the family, and sometimes these were relatively young children, or had to deal with, oh my God, my child has cancer. And so I had experienced that kind of pain and anxiety and confusion that was coming from my interviewees. And then I had a friend whose 4-year-old was diagnosed with an aggressive multiple myeloma. when he was 4 years old. And she only found it by accident. It was a lump near his collarbone. And they went, she took him to the pediatrician the mm-hmm. next day. And the pediatrician said, go immediately to the ER at Children's Hospital. Do not pass go. And they didn't leave that hospital for 38 days.
Whoa.
And so reading her journal really helped me appreciate, and I also visited her and brought her in my first book, helped me to appreciate just the angst and the, this happened to be a miracle baby in that she was over 40 when she had him. And it was such a total upheaval in their lives. And this beautiful little boy was going through such trauma and became needle phobic and all mm-hmm. of the kind of negative associations that kids tend to have with hospitals, that I thought, there's got to be a way to help people who are going through this and either have to explain to children what's happening. When the child says, will daddy die?
Right.
And you don't know. There are resources that can help you figure out how to answer that question and how to even introduce the idea. And there are important resources to help you figure out whether you're getting the right kind of care for the child who is diagnosed with cancer. I really wanted to bring those to the fore. And it's a small book. It's only 60 pages. But it's really focused on what are the challenges right now, the urgent communications and treatment challenges, and where can you go for the really best information that's available?
And that's great, because a lot of times the parent will also have another child who may feel left out.
Yeah.
Because the other child with cancer is getting all the attention, and it's also hard for the sibling to...
I had a couple of really interesting stories mm-hmm. From the first interviews, where one of them was a teenager older than the young man who had been diagnosed. And one day she went up to her mother. She was about 16, and she said, do I matter anymore?
Oh.
And the brother was in treatment, and, the mother and father were just so focused on getting through every day that they were assuming she was fine. And one of the lessons in Things I Wish I'd Known, Cancer in Kids, is don't assume that the other kid is fine, but set up the kinds of, so you have accessible to you resources that the child is already comfortable with, the healthy child. There are counseling resources, there are teachers, there are coaches, there are sports coaches, and one of those people undoubtedly has a relationship with the healthy child to be able to be a resource. So if you can't find the right kind of kid support group, or for some reason the healthy child doesn't want to participate in that, you need to at least let the resources at the school know what's happening in case, the child starts acting out in an unpredictable way.
Right. And it's always hard for the other sibling. From all the people that I've talked to. And this is such a great resource, because like I said, a lot of parents, they're just overwhelmed and they just don't know where to turn.
It really is true. And I think the younger the children, either needing to explain a parental cancer or needing to explain why it is we're now going to the hospital and you're having to get 10 shots a day or 10 needle sticks a day.
Right.
The younger the child is, I think the more challenging the communication becomes. And so there's almost a feeling that I have to find a cover story, or I have to find, some way to make it seem like everything is normal when it's not, and it's clearly been turned on its head. And I think the most important lesson for me in talking to people who are experts in dealing with kids around these problems is that if you don't tell them what's happening, they will assume that something is happening that is far worse, probably.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Then what's really going on?
And kids are resilient. I mean, they'll understand. Like you said, if you keep them in the dark, it'll be much, much worse.
I had a couple of parents who said to their children, and of course, children of different ages, it becomes a challenge. Do you talk to them together? Do you talk to them separately? But they usually said, I don't know whether daddy will die or not. And all I can tell you is we are doing absolutely everything we can do to make sure that it comes out well for Daddy and for us.
Right.
And as I learn things, I will tell you more. And I think the credibility of the caregiver in explaining cancer to the children and in helping them feel that they're getting the straight scoop is really important, and it can be undermined too easily.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, you said it right there. I mean,
this little boy who was in the children's hospital for 38 days, when he was going to start getting aggressive chemo, and he started losing his hair, he was really upset. So his dad shaved his head too. And of course now, I mean, the big deal is everybody shaves their head
right.
in sympathy. But, you know, for a little 4-year-old, that was a really big deal to see that his father's head looked like his head. So it wasn't such a problem.
See, I wanted the exact opposite. My boyfriend wanted to shave his head. And I'm like, I don't want to go around looking at me being bald and you being bald too. Come on now.
You know, and it's really figuring out what's right for this situation.
Right.
For the little 4-year-old, it was perfect. For you, it wasn't.
Exactly. So do you have any new books roaming around in your head that you're thinking about writing?
Not yet.
But,
you know, one of the topics that is really interesting to me is how people heal.
Yes.
And I've had several, I would say, 3 or 4, it's maybe 5% or more of the, or 10%, let me do 10% of the people I interviewed who had lost a spouse have gotten remarried.
Right.
And are happy and have families. And, you know, I had one young woman who has kept in touch with me who said a year ago, she kept in touch because we had some professional things in common and I was giving her some coaching and we just got along. And so, you know, periodically she'd call me, and at one point about a year and a half ago, she said, "And I just want to make it clear, I've rediscovered myself. I knew I had lost myself in caregiving.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself again. I don't need a man in my life. I'm going to be just fine. The kids are going to be just fine."
That's good.
And now she's on the verge of getting married. And she surprised herself, and I said to her, "You know, Joanne, it's probably because you decided you weren't on the hunt, and
exactly.
here he is."
Exactly. And the most important point of that story is she found out who she was before, just because I know not necessarily just survivors or caregivers, but a lot of people feel that they can't live without another person, whether, you know, male, female,
yeah.
boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. But
yeah.
I believe finding yourself after cancer, if you lose your spouse, or your spouse decides, or boyfriend, girlfriend say, "You know what, I can't deal with this." I've heard of people who walk out on their, well, I'm just like, whatever, but
I had one of those.
Yeah.
And I also had a fellow whose brother walked away on him.
Whoa.
I call them the pullaways.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of us has people that we thought we could count on, but I think you don't really know until a diagnosis like this hits. And one of the young women that I talked with was engaged, and her fiancé walked away.
Whoa.
And now she has adopted a baby, and she is a single mom, and she is just incredibly happy. And so I think she happened to be a survivor of a very aggressive cancer, breast cancer. And I think what's important is for people to recognize that there is a risk of literally losing yourself in the process,
whether
it's survival or caregiving.
I agree. And look at that, we're almost out of time. Deborah, isn't that crazy? Half hour goes pretty fast.
It is crazy. It went very fast, and I so enjoyed talking with you.
Same here. So we can find out more about you on your website, Things I Wish I Had Known. There's links to purchase the book, a lot of good resources and everything. And is that the main way that people can get a hold of you, Deborah?
That's right. There's a website called www.thingsiwishidknownnopunctuation.com,
right.
And they can read testimonials and reviews. There's a resource section where there are electronic links to various tools that can be helpful to them. And there's a blog where I'm keeping up on some of the latest research and some of the latest issues. And the book is also, there's a purchase link, but the book is also, both books are available on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble.
Excellent. It was great talking to you today, Deborah. If you just hang on, I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. This is Mel Medeiros. I am the Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And as always, life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's the Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.